And tonight, Jim Harp is going to tell his story. Please welcome Jim.
Thank you. my name is Jim Harp, and I am an alcoholic. It's been a hell of a week. I had a death in the family this week, and lost a very precious niece who drank herself to death. She died from alcoholism. And I did not think her death should be in vain, so I put a picture of it on one of the bulletin boards out there. Have a look at this beautiful girl and seeing that she's a rarity. She's one of those few people who decided, given the choice between living and drinking, she took drinking. And that's about all I'll say about that. But anyway, all these things are, they're a tragedy. And we don't get to really know it, because we say about this, about people, we come in, oh, and this one died and that one died. We throw out these numbers and becomes part of statistics. And can you guys hear me okay? And we do it. So I decided we ought to put a picture with this. Who was this person? What did they do in their lives? And I've seen a series of these in my sobriety. He's right. I was born in Columbus, Georgia, but that was kind of a lie. I was raised across the river for about 17 years in a place called Phenix City, Alabama. And it's right across the river. Now, that doesn't mean anything to most of you people in here. But in the 1940s through the 1950s, this little city, population 15,000 people, I believe, at that time, took in over $200 million a year in gambling, prostitution, and every other illegal activity you can think of. I got a friend named Bobby Jones who also comes from there. And his mother ran a cafe there that my father ate breakfast at. And his mother, a place called the Elite Cafe. There was nothing elite about that cafe, except that they sent the money to Chicago, from what Bobby told me at that time. That was odd. We never really got introduced to each other till I had been sober 10 years, and we met up here. Bobby was a enforcer for the mob, and I was just from Phenix City, Alabama, with nothing to recommend me like that. And so that was the beginning of my childhood. I was raised there for most of my life, and it was different. It was almost kind of like New York in a way. You know, if you live in New York, you almost always have to be competitive. Just getting on the subway up there is competitive. And that's the way it was where I came from. Everything that you did in life is competitive. There's always somebody out there looking to take your money, cheat you at cards, do stuff. Everything was just crooked. And I never ended up in jail or prison there because my uncle was the chief of police, who was also the biggest crook in town. And my life pretty much was poor. And I come from a family of six children in my family, three boys, three girls. And three of us have had problems with alcohol. Two are definitely alcoholic. The third one is yet to be determined, but he's working his way towards it, this fraternity. And I moved to Atlanta when I was very young, and then spent most of my time here. And I never thought of alcoholism ran in my family. Maybe it galloped in my family. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My father, my mother. And when I was little, must have been about 8 years old, I remember my father asking my grandfather, "Daddy, did you drink my brake fluid?" And without a chaser. And that was it. And I loved this old man. I just loved him. My father was away at the war, and two wars, and he's the one who looked after me, and he was everything that I kind of wanted to be. He was a trapper. You don't meet many of those people anymore today. You know, what's your vocation? I'm a trapper. And it was his influence. He gave me my first drink of liquor when I was 3 years old. My first cigarette after that, he rolled it for me. And I did everything he did. I copied him. And you can imagine living in a place off an Indian reservation. And it was just a groundswell of emotion. And then later on, this was bringing on to my problems that I was having later in my life in religion. We went to one of these evangelistic churches that my father and mother attended, and I despised it. I hated it. And one day he just got up, and he was one of those people who went up to be saved. God was going to save him. He shook and trembled as he went up there. He kneeled down at the altar and promptly had a cerebral hemorrhage and fell over and died. So for some reason or another, I stayed away from churches for the next 30 years. How I drank. I never really noticed that I had a problem. Everybody else in my family did have a problem. But in, I guess it was 1960s or whatever, my life was going pretty good. I was in school, I was studying, but I was in and out of school all the time. And I never thought much about, it was one party after another, with fraternity parties or this kind of stuff. And I never paid a lot of attention to anything else much. Studying came pretty easy to me. And I did everything on the last day. And when I got into graduate school, my friend Sonny said, "You're going to be typing your paper as you drive and on the way to class." And I could do stuff like that because I could do stuff like that. And I got good enough grades to go on to college and then get offered some scholarships to some pretty good schools in this country. And all of them I was thrown out of after a while. But I just thought I was part of the good guy group who drank their way and did this and did that. And I think I had my first really drinking spree, though, during that period of time. And I decided that something was missing in my life, so I ought to get married. And so I started looking around, and first girl come up my way, she was a singer. She was a folk singer. She used to sing Joan Baez stuff at a place called the Bottom of the Barrel here in Atlanta. Baltimore place. And she was from New York. She was Jewish. And I didn't know what a bagel was. And neither family was anxious for the two groups to come together, so we eloped. We got married, ran off and got married in a place called Saltillo, Mexico. We drove through 2,000 miles of Mexico in a Volkswagen. And and soon a son was born, and after that a daughter. And when I was working at a hospital here in town, I got called over the, this was going back a little bit, but I got called to, by the hospital, stat call came over in the hospital and said they needed me in the laboratory right away, and I knew exactly what it was. They wanted me to give blood. And I'm O negative, which is a universal donor. I can give to anybody. And so they gave me, come in, I gave the blood, they gave me $50 and a half a day off. And I remember, God, this is great, I got $50. And I remember this bar downtown I really loved. And so I took my $50, I went down there, and it was kind of tropical. It was dark, right where the Georgia Power building was downtown. And I went in there, and it had plastic palm trees and, you know, and Hawaiian music. And I just loved going in there, you know. And there's some chick sitting in there, some lady sitting in there with a sailor cap pulled over her head. And I said, "I'll have what she's having." I think it was a Singapore sling. And she had like two of them. I said, give me two of them too. And so I was like that, and I tried to strike up a conversation with her. And she said, young man, if you're trying to pick me up, I got to tell you beforehand, I think I'm an alcoholic and a nymphomaniac. So I looked at the bar, and I looked at the bartender, and I said, there is a God. And and I didn't remember much through that night and the next couple of nights that we had a sort of sleepover. And I said, what did you do again? She says, I teach Navy combat. Yeah, I said, yeah, I sort of thought you did. And that's what I did. I mean, it was drink, pursue women, drink, pursue women, drink, go to school, drink, pursue women, and that was my life. And that period of time is that although I stayed pretty faithful in my marriage when I got married, this was before I got married, and that's the way I was always, there's that change in me is I am pretty much a loner, as a lot of my family, we are, as my brother always lives deep back in the woods, whatever, and I don't know, maybe this, I think it's in the whole family, my father was like that. But I did one drink, and I became immediately sociable, and I was looking for action. And I didn't care where it was at. Also, I was a periodic. I did not drink every day. And pretty much my life went pretty much according to this. I was offered a job in New York at NYU, School of Medicine. There I began to teach, and mostly, I was the type of, I was not a physician, but I had done pretty well in my studies and everything in graduate school, and went on to teach at NYU. But again, it was always that restlessness, that irritability, that longing for something I did not know what was. I never thought of it during that period of time, but it seems as though I lived my life as waiting to drink. I loved getting away from my family. I loved trips out of town. And because I could be fully most who I was at that time. The persona I took in the hospitals, everything else that I did was, it was true in that way, but it really was not who I was. That's all that I ever thought about was to get away, and I could be that person, and that longing I could see never seemed to feel. It was always that void in me, and the marriage with her, surprisingly, we knew each other probably only 30 days, lasted almost 18 years. She still is one of the finest women I've ever met, and was my best friend during that period of time. My second wife was not so lovable, but at this time I was I worked my way. I continued drinking, and in before I quit, though, is that this other story is that I had a week off. I was working. I had taken a job. I had left New York and took a position at the University of Miami. By that time, I'm separated from my first wife, and. And that living to drink thing that I did all this time was all that I cared about. By this time, my drinking is getting worse. But I'm not. I've never been arrested. I've never lost a job because of drinking. None of that stuff ever occurred. But I was doing some research and like that. And a lot of times, I'd do 32, 34 hours over a weekend. And that time I was working with a researcher at University of Miami, Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, and I was doing neonatal work, neonatal research, and, you know, these are premature babies, and we were doing some studies and everything, and God, it had been a weekend. It was July the 4th weekend coming up, and I had like 10 days off, and I just could not wait to be off. And I worked all night, and that morning I left the hospital. I remember on my way home. I'm driving along Collins Avenue on Miami Beach, and I've got to get something to drink. I got all this time off, so I go into the store, and I'm driving at that time a Lincoln, and I go in to get a case of beer, and I come back out, and the car is running, and all the locks are locked, and I'm standing there with my carrier of beer, and I said, "You know, you did it to me again. You know, you're always doing this shit to me. And, you know, I've been good. I worked with those neonates all night. I did a good job with them, and you pulled this shit on me." I'm talking to this guy. I said, working with these neonates, I said, "I'm really starting to love the little bastards, you know." And kicking the door. That's what I'm doing. I'm kicking the door. And a woman on the other side, old woman in a walker, she come back up and she said, "Did you know your window's down on this side of the car?" And I just said, "I knew that." And that is how I drink. I live for the drinking. And I remember watching my dog. I had a dog for about 14 years, a golden retriever. And when I lived in Buckhead, I would take him over to a park over there, just let him free and let him run. And before he would get to the park, he knew where he was going. And he would start to howl in the back seat. He was going to be fully most who he was by running in the park. No more leash, nothing like that. And the same thing for me. Getting on to a plane to New Orleans, I'd start to howl. Because I was going to be fully most who I was. And that for me is fulfill that longing. And one of the other things, too, is that I was staying in pretty good shape at the time. I used to run about 5 or 6 miles a day at that time. And I was playing in a championship tennis tournament in Thomasville, Georgia. And I said, "Boy, you know, I'm in great shape. I finished. I beat a couple of guys." And temperature was like 130 degrees out on the court. And I was congratulating myself. And then that feeling hit me, that feeling of alcoholism, which is so ill-defined. And I knew from that point on I was going to go drink, and I didn't know when it would end. See, drinking was cathartic for me. If I could purge this stuff out of my head, out of my heart, out of my body, then I could function in your world again. And it only got worse as time went by. I got involved with another woman. My wife and two kids left me, went back to New York. And I can remember when that happened, that week and everything, of sitting in my car, sitting in that same Lincoln, and with a fifth or a quarter Jack Daniels and a couple of cases of beer. And I could not get unconscious. I had to get rid of the pain. I remember going up to a cement wall and running at it and hitting my head till blood ran in my eyes, trying to knock myself out. It was to get rid of that pain. As to this day, I don't know what that pain is from. On top of that, I got hepatitis. Not from a needle or anything, but actually trying to save an alcoholic at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we were putting a catheter in his heart, and he was blowing bloody foam out of his lungs and bleeding all over the place. And it was before AIDS, and I had scratches and stuff from working in the yards and everything all over my arms. And that continued on, and then up to the point I got caught for my first DUI in 1982, I think it was, and I was walking. I called a friend of mine who was a lawyer here in town, and my wife got me out, but she was disgusted with me. And And I told Jack, I said, you know, my wife thinks I'm an alcoholic. And he says, maybe you are. And that was the last thing I was wanted to hear. He said, you know, anybody who's married to a bitch like that ought to drink, you know. Anybody who would put up with that kind of shit ought to drink. You need to drink more. That's what I wanted to say. And so I came in here, actually, October the 12th, 1983, because I got out of jail on my birthday. And I came in here and I took one look around. I said, oh, Jesus Christ, what the hell have I got myself into? Look at these people. This is where the whales come to die. And I don't want to be a part of this. And somebody said, you know, why don't you get up and get a white chip? I said, go get your own fucking white chip. I don't want it. I did not want what you had. I did not want it. As bad as my drinking was, that I did not want what you had. And I went to like three meetings in 1983. I think it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And I came and I listened and everything. And I thought, I think it was on Sunday or Monday, whenever they used to do the speaker meetings back in the early 80s. And then I got some girl up here was talking about telling her story. It talking about all the trunk, all the drugs she'd done, and all the parties she had been to, and all her sexual gymnastics and so forth. And well, by Tuesday I had made a decision. I thought that you were a sick group of people, but I didn't think I could help you. I did think I could help her. I never saw her again, but. I went back out I didn't go back out because I never came in during that period of time. I never took a chip. But that was it. I could not think about living without alcohol. It was just impossible. And in 1984, after a series of problems, but mostly with my kids and stuff like that, them talking to me, trying to convince me who I was and say, you know, really, Dad, you know, this, you really got a problem. And I went to a bar there in Fort Lauderdale and had one drink. And I got up and I walked away. I said, you know what, you know, you're no alcoholic, you're great. I went back the other night. I had two beers and walked away. Well, you're pretty, you know, you got a problem drinking, but you're a pretty good guy. By the fourth night, I don't remember the fourth night, I had drank myself unconscious again. And I did it, and this was a God shot in my life that at a little bar, as you go over Sunrise Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale, there was a little pub over there, and it was dark and cozy. I love those dark places. I sit in there and drink, and lucky I went in there, and there was a guy who had 3 years in the program, and he went back out. And, he said, I get home, my wife is going to kill me. She's just going to kill me. And then I remembered enough AA slogans from 3 or 4 years, you know, when I was over here last year. I said, well, you're right where you're supposed to be or something. I kept torturing that man all night long. But every time he would get up to leave, I would grab him by his belt and said, sit your ass back down. You're not going anywhere. And I kept buying him drinks. And when I look back on it, is that this was put in my life, and I took it, and I thought about it, and I packed up my suitcase, and I came back in here exactly on the date of October 12th, 1984, and by this time, I was ready. Good, I've covered a little bit of my drinking and everything. That's about all I wanted to cover with that stuff, because I really want to talk about my sobriety. That is much more important than the stuff I did when I was young and crazy. And I came in here, and I immediately picked out, I came to meetings, I sit down here, I listen to your board, you know, I listen pretty much to your boring shit every day and your little bumper sticker talk and, you know, don't drink, don't think and go to meetings and all this stuff, and it made me sick. And, but I came. Nevertheless, getting sick off of it, I came. And I can remember in that period of time, I started to want to come. And I kept coming back. And sometimes I do 3-4 meetings a day. I just stay here all day and pace back and forth. And my life began to change. And November of 1984, I opened a business in the medical profession, and by being in here about 3 years, it was multi-state covering. The business was like multi-state covering 4 to 5 states. I had a nursing business that run up through as far as north as Virginia, and my projected income for 1987 was one hell of a lot of money than anything that I could imagine. But I didn't quite make it, and I didn't do very much in the program at that time. At my third year, my wife and I separated, and my second wife and I separated. And at the same time, I remember my business starting to fall. I could not borrow any more money because my business was so big, I just could not keep up with it anymore. And then piece by piece, I had to sell off pieces to other companies and so forth. They got very rich. I stayed, eh. But I packed up my bags. I was feeling just as sorry for myself as I could be. And during that period of time, I did not work with other alcoholics. I did not do the things that I was supposed to do in the program. All I did is I came in, I went to meetings, I went home, and I stayed sober and I ran my business. So that was pretty much where my priorities were. You just can't two-step it in here. Is that God knows I never took a drink during that period of time, but I can remember my second wife standing outside of my house, and right behind, you know, where they have the Buckhead Covenant group meeting, Presbyterian Church. We had a storm that year, and it cut my house in half, and a tornado came through there, took out the tree. But before that happened, my wife, she says, you know, you think you've changed since you stopped drinking, but you know, you're the same old sorry bastard I've always known. She says, you are so selfish, I don't think you're capable of being honest. That hurt my feelings. And what you didn't know is I had a girlfriend down in Boynton Beach, Florida. About midnight, I was waiting to hear from her. And she called me and stuff like that. And I told her I was coming down to see her, and I thought she would be warmed by that. And she stopped, and she didn't say nothing for a minute. She says, you think you've changed since you stopped drinking? If I'd had a dog at that time, he would have peed on my leg. My business was going down. I was getting a divorce. Everything was right. And so I was right a little over 3.5 years sober, I guess, at that time. And I was so used to everything happening my way. And when I left for here, nothing would go right. Nothing would go right. And so I talked to Stan Parks, the guy whose name is on the front of this up here, and I started to do part of my night step. I did it so reluctantly. I started in Pine Mountains in Georgia where my parents were buried. I remember sitting there and it's cold and rainy and reading this letter to them and saying stuff they did, alcoholism and what I did, trying to fess up and my soul and tears running down my eyes and trying to come it, and I just felt as bad as you can feel, you know, as, without being drunk. And I went on down there, and nothing would change. They would not grant me a state license. There was a hindrance with that. And then one day I got a call from my son in Atlanta who was running the piece of business I had left. He said, Mom's in the hospital, and they're going to operate on her, and she's got to have a bilateral mastectomy. And though we hadn't been married for a number of years at that time, that really hurt me. And but as far as I know, it was one of the few times in life that I felt something for somebody else that wasn't me. And I went there, and she was rolled into the operating room, and they did a frozen section on her, and it was negative. And they rolled her right back out. And it turned around like that, and that boosted my esteem a lot, because at least she was doing better. That night, I went to a place called the Fifth Chapter in Fort Lauderdale, and to a meeting, and I was self-pity was just pouring out of me, and that, and I remember this guy, he got up, he was, do you need to get that, So I looked at this guy, and before I left, this is important. I forgot about this. Jack, a guy who was sober about 40 years before he died just about 3 years ago. And I sit and bitching and moaning about my ex-wife, and he finally, he slammed his fist down on the table, and he said, Jim, listen to me. You're going to have to start taking responsibility for your own life. I didn't quite understand that at that time. I was shocked that he said that to me, you know. Me take responsibility for my own life? And when I was down there with Cheryl going through the surgery, and her things, I went to the Fifth Chapter that night, and this guy got up, and it was one of those 30 minutes, 30 and 30 meetings where you talk for 30 minutes, and then you have a discussion for 30 minutes. And I began to pour my soul out to him and whatever it lane, how bad my wife had been and how bad this was going and nobody loved me and my clothes didn't fit, you know, and that kind of stuff. And nothing's going right for me in Florida either. And he said, Jim, you're going to have to wake up and smell the coffee. Start taking responsibility for your own life. Then it happened. Everything was taken away. It's like the room was just filled with light. And everything made sense. It just came home to me at that moment. And I could have danced out of that place. I made a commitment then that night to do some 12-step work, that I would try to give back a little bit of what was being given to me, even though I was still pretty much relatively early in sobriety. And I did. I started going to jail meetings and Salvation Army meetings. I was okay with money, so I wasn't working very much. But I moved from that place up to West Palm Beach, and that I was staying in. It was pretty much a hole, trying to save on money. And then something happened in West Palm Beach. There's a saying is that life gives us moments, and then to those moments we give our lives. And that's what was going to happen to me the next day. I said a prayer. Show me what you want me to do. I'll do it. And I was out on the beach. I was reading, working on my tan, checking out the girls like that. And I walked out of there, and I looked over to my left, and there was a guy there, the most sorrowful human being I had ever seen in my life. From the size of him in the car, I'd say he was about 6'4", 6'5". Had these cold, steel blue eyes. And the man was so lonely looking. And he had a beat-up old station wagon, Toyota station wagon. And in it must have been everything that he owned in life. It had been thrown back there. And I went there. I never said a word to this man. I stopped. I started to. But you don't interfere in other people's lives, you know. And in the interim, I had picked up some work at St. Mary's Hospital in West Palm Beach. And that night, at about 11 o'clock at night, that guy came into the ER, dead on arrival. And I noticed something about him. He'd got a haircut. He was dying, and he meant to die there. And he was drinking himself to death in that car. He may have had some other medical problems, I don't know. And that would change my life. Because every day, I let that man stay where he was at when I could have helped. And so I swore before God I would never let that happen again. I've seen in the medical field, we see a lot of people die. It's a natural thing. And but this really bothered me. You know, why was this just somebody's little boy? What happened to him? What happened to him so badly in life? Had taken so much out of him, and he no longer wanted to live. And over the years, I have a friend who's been sober about a couple of years less than me. And it was three men who would get together and talk. And they were all about the same amount of time in the program, and we met at different houses, and we did this and that and everything. And my friend Sonny one night called me, or his girlfriend called me, and said that his 13-year-old daughter had shot herself in the head. And I saw what emotional pain was like when I saw him crawling around on the floor and just trying to get away from that pain. And I knew what he felt like. And later on, we started going down to West Palm Beach together. And we did fourth and fifth steps down there for like 10 years. We wrote, we did, we went down and we talked. And we ate at the same restaurant for six nights out of seven every week. If they'd been open 7 nights, we'd been there 7 nights. And we created this routine until, I guess it was 1999 or 2000. We said we have nothing left to talk about. We've done it all. And we have had a party, and then we've come back to be friends again here lately. And but I just didn't think I had anything left. From that experience and from that white light experience and then from the experience with this man in the hospital and everything, I began to change my life. You talk to people who were here when I first came in, they'll tell you I wore nothing but three-piece suits. Always tan, always looking good, always proper. That was who I was. And I remember that there had to be something more to life than just making money. I wanted to do all right. I didn't want to starve. I didn't want to be poor. But I just could not devote my life to that. And so I wondered what I would do with my life now. So I said a prayer. And the next day, I saw a very beautiful woman. She was singing at the old Oxford bookstore at Peachtree Battle. I took one look at her, and my hair caught on fire. And I found out that she sang in a church. Now, you remember my experiences in churches. So I said, well, I can go to church. I can do that one more time. I can go to church. So I followed her in there, and she was sure enough sang in the choir. And I said, I want to join your church. And it happened to be the Catholic Church. Now, you just don't go into the Catholic Church. It takes like 10 months or something with them teaching you stuff and this and that and learning how to do all the stuff and the rituals and so forth. And finally, I had lunch with her one day. And I said, very proud of myself, I said, I joined the church. And she looked at me and she said, what the hell for? I said, huh? I said, you sing in the church. She said, I'm an atheist. They paid me to sing in the church. I have my master's degree in voice from Vanderbilt. I was stay stuck in the church, and I saw her one more time after that. And I wanted to come in, you know, and ask her, was it something I did? Was it something I said? Was it my drooling? What was it, you know? And there I was. But then I was to meet some other people. And now my life is beginning to get full of these things. Whatever my intention is, it takes me to something else. And though not seeing her again, I went to this church, and I met a lot of friends there, and people were nice to me, and it was good. It was a social occasion, and we were having lots of social things to do. And then this girl, the other girl I was dating, she said, "You know, Jim, you know, you always thought about doing stuff." She says, "Well, you want to help people? Why don't you join this ministry over here, the Stevens Ministry thing?" And it's like a lay ministry and everything. And so I did. It was put in front of me. I did it. And I started going up to visit people in Shepherd Hospital and in Piedmont. And I did this and that. And, you know, said, "Jim, you know, there's a graduate program here in theology. Why don't you do that?" It got put in front of me, so I did it. And one day he said, "You know, Jim, we're taking this little trip to Israel. Why don't you do that?" It got put in front of me, and I did it. And when I was on this trip, I fell in love with the ruins. I loved the history of the place. And I wanted to get to know more about it. What were they like? What did they eat? How was it? And so in 1995, I took my first archaeological trip to Ashkelon, done by the Gaza Strip. And I worked for the Semitic Museum in Boston, and I did it. They at the end, they said I had done a good job, but I come back. Teach. And I thought of myself as poor white trash coming up from Phenix City, Alabama, and I'm being offered a teaching position by Harvard University just for the summer or whatever. But, yeah. One other thing before I finish here is that when Sonny and I did all that work, I thought I had uncovered everything about myself that could be uncovered. That I had, it's what Chuck Chamberlain used to say, is uncover, discover, discard. And I guess I was sober at this time for quite a long time. And I was going through a bad week. I was, first thing I noticed when I get out of sorts is my temper. And it had been bad. I'd taken a few people's heads off of stores and this and that, and I was just feeling miserable. And it just dawned on me and everything. I couldn't find out what the hell it was. And just for some period that night, I just started to cry. And I started to sob. And I tried writing it down. Nothing would come out like that. Then I remembered. There was something that reminded me of something in a movie I'd seen. I said, "I'm going to go rent it and see if I can pick up what the key was." The movie was called Schindler's List. And it was towards the back of the movie. And the war is coming to an end. Schindler's leaving. He's got all of his money in the bank. And he's given away everything he has. Everything. And he starts saying, "I could have given away this ring. It would have saved 2 more lives. The car would have saved 5 more lives." And he starts sobbing. He's given away everything he has. And he wants to give more. Then I remembered. Then I remembered what it was. October 1987, it was my birthday. My wife had brought a present for me. Though even though we're separated, she got me a gift. My 3-year-old daughter, Ashley, remembers it's my birthday. She runs out of the room. She comes back, and she's got a top of a Monopoly box, and it's full of pennies. And all the Monopoly money piled on top of it. "Here, Di, is your birthday present." I said, "Honey, I said I can't take your gift. And she started crying. She'd given everything that she knew to be valuable, and it still wasn't enough. And I knew at that moment what was wrong with me. I was not capable of that. There was a selfishness in me. Maybe it was from, you know, when I sold papers at Fort Benning that I got in a fist fight with two guys on a truck, and I got second and third degree burns from my scrotum up to the back of my head. And they put me out on that road to die. Maybe it's when my seventh grade teacher asked me, why aren't you in school? And I told her I had no shoes. And I understood the reasons why in my childhood that I held on tightly to everything in life. That was my awakening. And the other thing it taught me about humility. And humility cannot be purchased at a bank. You can't dig it up outside in the ground. And it was for me at that time is when I asked myself, how on earth did somebody love, how could somebody love me that much that they give everything that they have? And that was at 13 years sober. Things continue to get better. Ups and downs, the suffering of sobriety, the hurt and the pain of sobriety, and it does. That all I've had ever had to do in this program is show up. I'll leave you with this. As a teacher, I used to go see, was a professor when I was teaching at NYU. And his name was Joseph Campbell. And he held these conferences. I think it was called Needle's Eye or something like that. I can't remember. It's a lot of years ago. But I remember something he wrote, that each of us carries the cross of the Redeemer, not in our great victories, but in the silence of our own despair. And it's not the outside world that will save you, but the reverse of that may be true. Live, Nietzsche said, as though that day were here. Thank you for your kind attention.
First I slept, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. I look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Take me.